session number 24570, Reel 5.
Piers Plowright, Reel 5. Now, what was your next move from EPO?
Around October 1957, that's exactly a year after I joined Her Majesty's service, I went up to the Cameron Highlands. I can't quite remember how I went, but I suspect it was in the same grey Land Rover, which I've mentioned, the Intelligence Corps Land Rover, and I was going up there to work under an officer whose name I remember, Captain J.T.A. Lynn, L-Y-N-N, a man with a family living up in the Cameron Highlands. Now, the Cameron Highlands were famous for being a place of rest and recreation. They were cool. If I say 5,000 feet up, does that sound right? It's a rough guess. But they were cool and high and very beautiful, and they had a great golf course, and they had peculiar things like the Smokehouse Inn, which was a complete replica of an English pub with Tudor beams, a fire, people wore sweaters. Extraordinary, really. And the main little town was called Tanarata, which literally means flat earth. And
do you know how to spell that?
T-A-N-A-H, Tana, Rata, R-A-T-A. Tana is earth and Rata is flat.
And that's where you were based?
That's where I was based. If you have to imagine the most serpentine hill you can possibly think of, you know, outdoing the sort of Italian mountains. For 27 miles, I think, it snakes upwards, left, right, hairpin bends. And if I hadn't learned to drive, well, I had about a year before I joined the army, but it really taught me driving going up that hill. It was fascinating for several reasons. One, of course, it was very ripe for ambush, and there had been some terrible ambushes there. So we normally went with the King's Dragoon Guards either side of us, little scout cars. They were also up at the top. But I remember the first time, I think I didn't go with an escort, perhaps because our Land Rover was considered safe enough and we had weapons, I don't know. And also because, let's face it, the emergency was scaling down at this point. But there had been ambushes of buses, there had been a particularly nasty killing of school children on a school bus. And there were famous bits of the road that were especially dangerous. I can't quite remember, but something like 16th mile, watch out, there's a bend there with a really good sheltering point for the insurgents, because remember that the jungle came right down to the road on either side. So you've got this twisting white road. Once, the only time I've ever had an accident was on that road, this is a digression, when I hit a Chinese vegetable van, but it was his fault, I think. But it was all fairly amicable, nothing serious done, and on we went. At the top of the hill, you come out of this exhausting climb with very little chance to stop, because there hardly any resting points, you know, and you didn't want to bung the road up. You came over a hump, and there to your left was a dip and a collection of tin bashers, tin and brick. Being much cooler, of course, that was possible. Round a little garage and not an officer's mess, some kind of building for... In fact, there weren't any officers there, so it was a little compound. About, say, let's say a dozen accommodation huts, a little naffy, a place to put the petrol in and things, and a big recovery vehicle whose driver I got to know very well, because vehicles always breaking down on the hill.
Was this an army?
This was completely army, and the people there were the Remy, which is the Royal
Electrical and Mechanical Engineers.
Thank you. The Royal and Electrical Mechanical Engineers. There was me from the Intelligence Corps, and there were odds and sods. I can only describe it as that, and quite what they were doing. I never worked out, but I suppose they were mostly Remy, I think. Paycor was there. Partly to pay you, and partly, I don't know, they had a little office. So that's where I lived, in this little tin hut, with about eight other guys. And I'll come to some of them, because I got to know them quite well. Then if you go on past the camp, you come to the little town, or village, really, of Tanarata, which in those days, I mean, being not unchanged, was a row of shop houses, classical shop houses, mostly owned by Chinese, Indian barbers. There was a photography studio where I had some pictures taken, run by a Chinese whose daughter Snowball. No, was she Snowball? I think we did call her Snowball, because there was also Operation Snowball. Anyway, she was round and jolly, and I would suspect promiscuous, but it never, I didn't test that, but she was very popular with the troops. There were little cafes with the marble top tables and the chairs and the mirrors I've described earlier. And at the end of it, on the left-hand side, just above the padang, the playing field where the helicopters would land, incidentally, it was a great place for helicopters coming and then going off on jungle patrol, was the police station, which was a fairly new building. And at the back of it was an old verandaed three or four office building, and I worked at the right-hand end of it with John Lam, L-A-M, a civilian Chinese clerk, and a lovely, lovely man. We established good... I suppose he became my best friend, really. He taught me Cantonese, or tried to. We used... Because a lot of time we weren't doing anything, I should say. And we sat in the office teaching... He teach me how to write Chinese characters and a little Cantonese. He and I had the maps with the pins. I'll come to them in a minute. The photographs and huge card indices of every known terrorist in our area, and what had happened to them or hadn't happened to them, and sightings of them. The sightings were compiled from these sit reps, I think I've mentioned before, coming in daily from the central police station. So-and-so spotted, query, was this so-and-so, you know. So we were there, sitting there, compiling, bringing up to date the card index, moving pins around the map, and getting involved in what I think was called Operation Snowball. I hope I'm not confusing it with the lady in the photographer's shop. Because it was wrapping up. The idea was that you were, from one surrendered terrorist, you were generating a lot more surrenders by sending him or her back with a very brave Chinese inspector who I remember extremely well, Inspector Bernard Tong, T-H-O-N-G, whom I've tried to get in touch with. I'm speaking now in the winter of 2002, and I've missed him by 2 months. He died in November 2002, because I'm going back to Malaysia next year. Bernard Tong was a young, very well-educated Chinese speaker, fluent English speaker too. I think his dialects were probably Hakka, Hokkien, Cantonese. I think he spoke a clutch. And he was an example of the very bravest, really, kind of police inspector, and there were probably about a dozen of them or more scattered around, who would dress up as terrorists, insurgents, whatever we like to call them, and go back into the jungle with a surrendered terrorist to meet the other unsuspecting terrorists who were having when you meet up by prior arrangement. It's not a recce.
A rendezvous.
Who were having a rendezvous in the jungle at an agreed moment. So what quite often would happen was that by now government propaganda was doing extremely well through two or three means. One was dropping leaflets, but they, of course, quite often got lost in the trees. Two was broadcasts with flying planes. And three was kind of word-of-mouth proclamation posters, which would get leaked through to them by their still a number of supporters, even if they're in the new villages, you know. The terms were complete amnesty once you'd made a full confession and agreed to help the occupying or government powers, but otherwise complete amnesty and some kind of work. I mean, you were fed, clothed, rehabilitated, and put back into society, unless you chose to go back to China. There'd been a lot of repatriation earlier on of suspects just sent forcibly back to China, which caused a lot of ill feeling, and I think in some cases... Sorry about that. There'd been a lot of repatriation of that kind to China in the early days. Now I think it was much more a question of resettling unless people asked to go. Of course, there were one or two exceptions. I'm not sure what sort of reception Chin Peng, the leader, would have got, though I suspect if he'd come out, the same would have applied.
So the basic surrender terms were just amnesty. I mean, they weren't looking to arrest and...
No. I don't think so. I mean, if you'd found somebody and you could prove a number of brutal murders, I don't quite know what would have happened. I don't know whether there was a case of that. But I suspect even then, it was so important to wrap the thing up that amnesty was total.
And so this Tong, Bernard Tong, would go into the jungle.
Let's go back to Bernard Tong. I can remember one or two incidents. I never went deep into the jungle. I didn't do jungle patrols, the really dangerous, difficult stuff. But I did occasionally... Let's give you a concrete example. isn't it sad? I can't remember the name of the particular terrorist, but let's call him Hong Ming, just for sake of argument. He was a CCM, that which was, what did it mean? A central committee member, CCM. Powerful, at the top. We knew he was in the area, and one of his lieutenants surrendered. We're talking about winter, December 57, something like that, when the terrorists are down. They were at their peak, they were about 5,000 or 6,000 people. I think by this stage we're talking about a few hundred, scattered here and there. Pera, where I was, and Pahang. That was the Kamenheiners, I think I'm right in saying, was just in Pahang. Ypres had been in Pera, was in Pera. There were still clusters because of the deep jungle area, and you're fairly far north. And remember that Chin Peng and his top brass have moved across the Thai border and are living a kind of strange life where the Thai authorities must have known, but nothing was done about them. So this lieutenant surrenders. There are various little lamplit meetings which I'm not invited to because I'm not top guy. And then I'm told that Inspector Tong, on such a night, should be coming out. He's going in with this lieutenant to keep the rendezvous, at which will be the Central Committee member and about 8 members of the platoon. If all goes well, Tong, who'd gone in on his own, let me just point out how brave that is, armed, but what could he do if those guys turn nasty? So he's risking a great, great deal. He would go in, and did go in on this occasion, to meet the 8 at the agreed time, and my job was to go with John Lamb in jungle kit by lorry to the jungle edge at an agreed point and go in probably half a mile or so at night to another agreed point. You're going down tracks, broad tracks, logging tracks, not, you know, into the leech country really. And there we would wait, there we did wait, I remember this evening very clearly, with a peculiar silence of the jungle. Others have talked about this, how the jungle is sometimes very noisy and sometimes extremely silent. And it seemed very silent that night, and you're waiting. What are you going to get? You're going to get nothing. You're going to get at what you hope for, which is Inspector Tong and the whole gang coming back. Or are you going to get some terrorists who've found out what's going on, killed Inspector Tong, and are about to kill you too? That was the, I mean, that's the nearest to danger I ever got. Anyway, it all went very, very smoothly. Inspector Tong arrives with everybody, all surrendered, cigarettes handed round. I had a lot of cigarettes in my pocket. My Malay was not too bad, so I could communicate in Malay. And we marched out. It's very interesting looking at these people as far as I could see them. A lot of relief, if one can describe it. That's how I seem to remember. A lot of smiles. Not sullen, as if they were glad the whole bloody thing was over, really, by that stage. I mean, it'd been an awful long time, and they were living on, you know, the supplies had been really denied them for a long time because of the new villages of Gerald Templer, which I think I've spoken about, haven't I? Yeah. So we put them all in the back of a lorry. I told them that they were being taken to the police station for debriefing. Of course, we took all weapons away. And we drove back to Tanarata Police Station. And they were handed over to the specialists, and Inspector Tong stayed with them. I wasn't there at the debriefing.
So you weren't present at the debriefing?
No, because I couldn't usually. It was all done in Hakka or Cantonese or whatever it was. John would have been useful, I wouldn't. And then I simply got reports of what had been said and other sightings and other links to other terrorists and so on. And that was really what was happening by then. It was being rolled up. That was a particularly dramatic evening. I remember another quite dramatic evening where we were, I took part in an ambush, but a very safe one from our point of view, that we were sort of just off the main road on the twisty road that came up from the bottom. The town at the bottom of the hill, by the way, I think was called Tapa, T-A-P-A-H, where there's a very nice rest house. I'll come back to that. So our job was me, really, I suppose, as I don't quite know why, as support, with a platoon of, I think, King's Dragoon Guards. They were I should say that they had a separate barracks, a little further up from my barracks. And they were an armoured contingent. They had their scout cars, but they were also jungle patrollers. And they were the fighting troops in the Cameron Highlands, not the supply troops. So me and a group of King's Dragoon Guards and their officer and a Chinese detective, I don't think it was Tong, and a Malay policeman, perhaps about a dozen of us, were expecting some Chinese to visit a site that's actually rather exposed when you think about it, near a pump house. Because what I chiefly remember was the pumping, the little pump in the silence and the darkness, going along, which sort of mirrored one's own heart a bit. And we waited all night for these guys and they never showed up, so there's not a dramatic story to tell there. But the idea was either to shoot them or capture them from our point of vantage. So I don't know whether the intelligence was faulty or they had found out, which quite often they did, and hadn't turned up. Those are my two moments of action.
Now, can you go into a bit more detail, if you can, about the methods you employed to track the movements of the terrorists,
well,
or insurgents? Or
yes, I think there were two different things going on. In the police station, John and I were simply collating information of, you know, records of sightings and plotting them on our little map with the pink pins. The maps, I can sort of see them today. They were pink. They might have had two colours. I think they might have three colours. We had colours for people who'd surrendered, because they represented movements of particular terrorists in our area. Colours for people who had been recently sighted, and maybe colours for more vague information, last seen at, etc. And we also had photographs. Ah, yes, because the big story has to come on this. We had photographs of every terrorist known to be in our area, very blurry very often. Sometimes they were photographs taken before they went into the jungle. Sometimes they were captured. I mean, photographs occasionally, the communists, the CTs, took photographs of each other in their camps, sometimes kind of propaganda pictures of them looking in groups, you know, looking very warlike and jolly, and sometimes just, I suppose, more intimate snaps, which were found on the bodies of killed terrorists or taken from captured terrorists. So we had a certain number of pictures to go on, and thereby hangs an important duty that I'd completely forgotten about, which was checking people, real terrorists as it were, against their photographs, which was easy if guys surrendered. You took photographs of them and you compared them and so on. But the morning that I grew up was when there was a lot of shouting in the yard. John and I were sitting, primitive typewriters we had. I never learnt to type, but we sort of one finger popping away, keeping the reports going. And round the corner came some King's Dragoon guards with poles, and on the poles were slung two bodies, one a man and one a woman. These were two terrorists just shot, well, shot perhaps 4 or 5 hours earlier, and brought into the yard. And John said to me, "Go on, you go out and identify them." And I had never seen a dead person, let alone a killed person, before. And I very well remember this, as if you're sort of frozen frame, really, the whole thing. I was absolutely scared, horrified, terrified. But much more powerful was my worry about being thought a sissy. And so I took the book of photographs that we had, as well as the wall chart photographs, and I went out to the yard and pretended it was all very routine. And there were two bodies, I say, one a man, one a woman, and the woman was pregnant, quite clearly pregnant. And what I remember was the unreality of it. I mean, people often say this about death, in ordinary natural death, the fixed features, the grey skin. Unfortunately, I remember the woman was sort of snarling, as if she had, either in pain or anger, as she was shot, and her teeth were exposed through the lips, and there were wounds, mostly in the body, but there was, on the face of the woman, I think there was a shot. Her face hadn't been shot away or anything, but it was nasty. And I wasn't sick. I didn't dare be sick. I just looked around, and I'm pretty certain who they both were, and I walked as steadily as I could back to the office and reported. There must have been a police inspector, and in my mind's eye, I can begin to see somebody, actually rather nice, with a gold tooth, who would have been a Chinese or Malay police inspector under whom John and I worked in the police station, but the name escapes me.
So you had this book of photographs, the maps.
Yes, and we had photographs on the walls and pink ribbon running from pins to the photographs. So, you know, the name, and then if we had the photo, and if there was no photo, just a blank space.
Now, the other thing you had was the card index.
Mm-hmm. That kept the details of sightings up to date, so that each time somebody was sighted, we would update the card index. So the date, where seen, or supposed to have been seen, what doing, and who with.
Pretty well the same as a depot.
It was. It just that I suppose the difference here was that we had our own little. It almost became like our own little party, you know, our own little group. Working smaller scale, EPO was looking across a much larger area and in a way much more distant. Here we knew the names of everybody, and of course great was the buzz if a high-ranking terrorist had been spotted.
Now, what were your sources of information? You mentioned the source of the photographs.
Yes.
So I can see that. But what were your sources of information about the movement? Can you run through what they were?
Yes. Well, I mean, the police reports that came in would have been compiled more centrally, perhaps in Ipoh, perhaps in Kuala Lumpur. And that would have been reports that had come from informers, of whom there were many, tappers who had seen something and were not afraid at this stage, I suppose, to report what they'd seen. Probably those two sources. The informers, as I say, could be anybody from...
Would you deal directly with them?
No, I wouldn't.
Would it be the Chinese police?
It would be the Chinese police. John Lam might have done some interrogations, but you see, it would very unlikely to be in the Tanahrata police station. But I do remember a guy who was a surrendered communist, a terrorist, and was kept on, I suppose, the police payroll, and sat around drinking coffee a lot, and occasionally would be asked to supply information, because he would know much more about the habits of the people he'd recently left than any of us. So he was kind of kept around, and he was a nice, smiling guy who would bring coffee to us and get himself coffee and smoke a lot, you know. And I suppose it was a cushy life for him, really. And he was giving information or helping to amplify information that had come in.
So that was... Any other aspects of the working of the police station?
Yes.
Your role within the
I should mention the officer, Captain Lin. What was he doing?
This is J.T.Y. Lin.
J.T.A., I think. JTA. If I said what... J.T.A., I think.
Do you know his first name?
John. Probably John Lin. Somewhere I have a letter that he wrote to my father, because John Lin and I didn't entirely get on, because I got the impression he thought I was a bit of a weed, and I thought he was a bit of a dry old stick.
Well, what was he in?
He was Intelligence Corps. He was a captain in the Intelligence Corps. And he was very brisk, and looking back on it, probably rather nice. But, you know, he'd been sent this long-haired, well, it wasn't any more long-haired, but sort of slightly egg-heady, impractical guy. And he found me vaguely amusing and sometimes irritating. I don't think I ever did anything shocking, you know, but I was his driver, amongst other things. And once a month, I would drive him down the windy hill, through Tapa, and into Ipoh for a bigger briefing, which he would attend, and I would simply be demoted there to driver, kicking my heels in the front of the police station. Captain Lin, anyway, was the liaison officer between the larger intelligence corps presence in Ipoh and our tiny unit, basically him and me, up in the Cameron Highlands. So I was a clerk, and he was a liaison officer.
So what would a typical day be like? I suspect there's not much.
Much more relaxed than it had been in Ypres, in the sense that army time didn't quite seem to be kept. It wasn't a reveille at 6 in the morning, anything like that. We got up in our own time. I mean, you have to have breakfast by 8 or something. Showered. Much cooler. Much, much cooler. And so we wore sweaters quite a lot, those army sea green sweaters. Civilian clothes, because as I've said earlier, I was supposed to be sort of undercover, but all that is nonsense when you drive a grey Land Rover. It is known to be an intelligence Land Rover. And your gun, if you're not wearing a sweater, is clearly visible under your arm. But so breakfast in the little mess there, little canteen. I would like to talk about the other guys in a minute. And then off to the police station, John Lam and I get down to our reading the papers, having our coffee. A little boy used to come round with a tray, and you ordered coffee and things from him from the police canteen. And then any sightings to be compiled, card indices to be upgraded. I don't remember meetings, but there must have been an ops room meeting every morning, just to sort of, as we'd had in Ipoh, to kind of report, to which I must have gone, but I don't remember them. It's very small, very friendly. Indian, there seemed to be quite a lot of Indian policemen around, Sikhs mainly. And I took lunch in the town. I'd go for Chinese makan lunch at one of the little cafes, coffee shops up the road. If there was a, you know, a big thing, like an evening, like the Inspector Tong incident, well, I probably went home early and had a rest, and then, because it was going to be late night and into the early morning. And the odd ambush thing, like I've described, going out with King's Dragoon guards, but not in a deep patrol, that I never did. I did have jungle kit, green and with a little hat, sort of floppy hat for the, I think all the chaps wore floppy hats with no sort of insignia on it. When Inspector Tong and co. were pretending to be terrorists, of course, they put the little famous little peaked hat on with the red star in front. And if you were a big boss, you had three red stars, if I remember. And troops did go in for disguise. You have these extraordinary moments described very well in Imperial War Museum records where people aren't sure who they've got in their sights. Are they enemy? Are they not? Because everybody's disguised as everybody else, you know. And there have been awful shoot-ups, which were own, you know, friendly fire, in quotes, and other times when, luckily, they held their fire because they recognised somebody or something like that. I didn't have any of that sort of muddle. Indeed, I was never fired at or never fired. I had this gun. I knew roughly how to use it. I don't remember shooting it once I'd done the training.
Now, what about the people who were with you? This John Lamb, now, what was he?
He was a civilian police clerk. I imagine rather like you get in any police force, not a trained policeman, not in uniform.
Was he Chinese?
Chinese. Yes. Cantonese speaking. Very educated, rather scholarly. I mean, he taught me a bit about Chinese poetry and things and read it. I believe, and I'm hoping to see him again, he would be exactly my age, so we were both sort of young men of 20, 21. Did he have a family? I can't remember where he went in the evenings. We went drinking sometimes, tiger beer, in one of the coffee shops.
He was a friend?
He was a friend. He was a friend. The other guys in my little camp were all British, except for the Malay servants, whom, you know, had a friendly jocular relationship with.
To the British guys.
Okay, well, they were the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, and let me single some out. There was Jerry the driver, tall guy from Barnsley, very good looking, beautiful voice, and he used to sing in the canteen, and said he wanted to be an opera singer. He was, you know, he knew music of all kinds, but he sang classical music, sort of Mario Lanza type arias. And Jerry drove this enormous camel, which was the biggest vehicle I'd ever seen. He once let me drive it round the square, and I could hardly get the wheel to turn, you know. Perhaps we didn't have any, assisted steering in those days. Huge, great thing, which he would go down the hill to recover vehicles that had come off the road or were blocking the road or whatever. Really nice guy. We had lots of jokes, and it's my great regret that I'd lost him. The guy, my best friend from Ipoh, didn't follow me up to the Cameron Highlands, Fred Billing, who I think I mentioned we did the paintings together. The other guys were a rather eccentric... Now, what was he? And also Remy, I think. Or possibly just straight Royal Engineers. Who later became rather a good architect. And his first name was Bob. And I met him again 5 or 6 years ago, and he brought photographs. He'd gone back to Malaysia because he'd got projects there as an architect, and he brought me photographs of...